From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The Supreme Court heard arguments this morning on the federal government's plan to ask about citizenship on next year's census. Next hour, we'll hear what the justices asked of both sides. This hour, we'll look at the High Court's decision to review whether federal employment protections extend to gay, lesbian, and transgender employees. We're on it right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And my thanks to Libby Denkman for hosting Air Talk the past couple of days, last Friday and yesterday. I appreciate it. Allowed me to be with my father when he had surgery on Friday, and he's recovering well. Glad to report. John Horn hosting Film Week on Friday as well, and my thanks to John. Coming up later this hour, the hidden camera investigation by Florida police against massage spas. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take up whether federal anti-discrimination laws apply to gay, lesbian, and transgender employees. The potentially applicable law is Title VII of the U.S. Civil Rights Act. It bars discrimination based on race, religion, national origin, and sex. Courts haven't agreed on whether a ban on sex discrimination includes LGBTQ Americans. With us to talk about the significance of the High Court taking on these two cases, as well as to hear one interpretation of Title VII, Sarah Warbelow is legal director of the Human Rights Campaign, civil rights organization based in D.C. Ms. Warbelow, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, what are the cases that are being combined here, and how does each of them get to this issue of Title VII's applicability?
So there are three cases that the court decided that it would hear. Two of them that explore the issue of whether or not gay, lesbian, and bisexual people are protected under our nation's non-discrimination laws that prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex. Those two cases are Bostick versus Clayton County and Altitude Express versus Zarda. In both of those two cases, which have been combined, gay men experienced employment discrimination when their employer found out about their sexual orientation. The third case, which is Harris Funeral Homes versus the EEOC and Amy Stevens, it's a question of whether or not transgender people are protected under our nation's non-discrimination laws that prohibit sex discrimination.
And that was a case of a funeral home, a home employee who was transitioning and was fired?
That's correct. Amy Stevens had a long career as a funeral home technician. She was very well respected in her field, had worked for this particular employer for a number of years. And when she let her boss know that she was transitioning from male to female, that she'd be coming to work as a woman, she was essentially fired from her job.
All right. So are these going to be two separate then oral arguments, the combined cases you mentioned and then the funeral home a separate hearing?
That is correct. Certainly the court could hear them on the same day or on different days, but they will be considering both of these two critical issues.
And let's talk about sort of the language that judges in the lower court decisions have provided as the legal reasoning. For example, in the second district court, this was the case of the skydiver, the Altitude Express versus Zarda, I believe it was, which the Second Circuit Chief Judge Robert Katzman said sexual orientation discrimination is motivated, at least in part, by sex, and is thus a subset of sex discrimination. But my question for you is, if Congress at the time the Civil Rights Act was passed in 64 had intended that sex applied to gay men or lesbian or transgender Americans, wouldn't they have specifically spelled that out?
Mm-hmm. The way that our nation's civil rights laws work and the way that the courts have interpreted our laws is to ensure that they get at the heart and the root of the discrimination that is occurring. You know, at the time Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we didn't even have language as a country for sexual harassment. But the Supreme Court determined that sexual harassment was an illegal form of sex discrimination under Title VII.
But we knew what gay men and lesbians and bisexual Americans were at that time. This was certainly known. If Congress intended to extend that, they could have done that.
You know, even Justice Scalia, when he was sitting on the Supreme Court, took into account in a case of one man sexually harassing another man to say we have to interpret our laws to get at the root evils of discrimination that the law was intended to address, even if that exact situation wasn't exactly what Congress was contemplating when it passed the law.
We're talking with Sarah Warbelow of the Human Rights Campaign. She's legal director of the D.C.-based organization. Also with me from Foundation for Moral Law, a Christian legal foundation, senior counsel John Aitzmo. Thank you, sir, for being with us. With the conservative majority on the court now, are you expecting it likely that the court will limit the application of Title VII so that it does not include gay men, lesbian, and transgender employees?
We think that's likely, and the reason we say that is that statutes really need to be interpreted in the mindset of the time in which they were adopted to understand what those who adopted the statute meant by it. This is a basic issue in both constitutional interpretation and statutory interpretation. And I certainly understand what Ms. Warbelow was saying in regard to the need to change with the times. However, that, I'd say, is the role of Congress. And if Congress wants to address sexual orientation or transgender, they can do so by amending the statute. But for the court to take it upon itself to say, we, although we are unelected federal judges, have decided that society has changed its values and therefore we are changing the meaning of the law, that is usurping upon unelected federal judges a great deal of power, power that I don't think we really want to delegate to.
The dissenting judge in that case, Altitude Express versus Zarda, Judge Gerard Lynch, wrote, he said, speaking solely as a citizen, I would be delighted to awake one morning and learn that Congress had just passed legislation adding sexual orientation to the list of grounds of employment discrimination prohibited under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. I am confident that one day, and I hope that day comes soon, I will have that pleasure. I would be equally pleased to awake to learn Congress had secretly passed such legislation more than a half century ago, until I actually woke up and realized that I must have been still asleep and dreaming, because we all know Congress did no such thing. That's Judge Lynch writing for the minority that even though he personally supported the protections being extended to LGBTQ Americans, that didn't see Title VII as doing it. But isn't there plenty of precedent for judges interpreting laws in more expansive ways as time goes on, as public attitudes shift? We know, for example, that American acceptance of same-sex marriage, now the majority of Americans are comfortable with it, support it. That's all happened in just the past few years. Isn't it appropriate for federal courts to take that into account and to interpret older laws accordingly?
Well, I will agree that we do look to what was the evil that the legislature was trying to address as we interpret the legislative statute. But in 1964, when they prohibited sex discrimination, they were not trying to address the issue of homosexuality, the issue of same-sex marriage, or the issue of transgender. Those were not things that they were trying to address at all. They were trying to address discrimination against them. And I would disagree in part with Judge Lynch there. I think he stated very well the more conservative view of judicial interpretation that until Congress changes the law, we and the bench really have no authority to do so. However, I would say also there are some solid moral reasons for the law in this area being as it is, that, well, there is certainly no moral issue in regard to being black or white or being of a certain religion or being of a certain sex. There are certain moral issues, at least many people believe there are, in regard to orientation and transgender, and I think an employer is certainly entitled to take these into consideration.
What about, though, the issue of sex essentially seems like meaning the same as gender? So the protection in Title VII, would you grant when they talk about discrimination being barred on the basis of sex, we're really talking about gender? And so if you're talking about a transgender individual who's going through the process of transitioning from one gender to another, I'm oversimplifying, but for the point here, is that not right in line with the protection of, against sex discrimination?
Well, we still have an issue as to whether or not gender is fixed. And whether or not sex is fixed, even the term gender itself is a bit of a nebulous term. But if we're going to take the position that the lower court took in the Harris case, that it, transgender is protected by this, well, because it's a subset of sex, well, what if, let's say, this person said, instead of coming in dressed as a woman because I have transgendered, what if the person says, I've decided that I'm a nudist, and so I'm going to perform funerals in the nude.
Or, well, that doesn't relate to gender, though, because transgender does. The reference to sex, I mean, setting aside gay men and lesbian is being covered, transgender obviously is about gender. Let me go back, though, to Sarah Warbelow, Human Rights Campaign. Is it for you at all easier to see a clear line with transgender, actually more so than gay men or lesbian here?
The case law is robustly developed around gender identity. You know, numerous federal courts, half a dozen federal circuit courts have interpreted sex non-discrimination laws to protect transgender people. The Sixth Circuit has ruled 4 times that transgender people are protected under sex non-discrimination laws. You know, certainly with respect to sexual orientation, the court is looking at a split amongst the circuits. But with respect to both sexual orientation and gender identity, these are concepts that are very much tied up with sex. It's hard to tease them apart. If you choose to discriminate against someone because she's a lesbian, what you're saying is that you disapprove of the sex or the gender of her partner, whether it's her wife or whomever she is dating at the moment. It is profoundly sex-based discrimination. And the same is true for transgender people. It is sex considerations, stereotypes about how men are supposed to behave, how women are supposed to behave, how men and women are supposed to appear, that underlies the discrimination against transgender people.
But when the reference to sex, don't you think that's about treating the person, the you know, individual one, the primary person here, in a discriminatory way because she or he of the gender of the person? The fact they're in a relationship with a man or woman, how do you make that leap as to that sex related because of the type of partner the person chooses? Because that then isn't applicable directly to the employee, him or herself.
Well, if an employer would not fire a man for dating a woman, but he would fire a woman for dating a woman, that is patently sex discrimination. It is treating two employees unequally based on their sex because of who they are associating with. The courts have long understood that civil rights laws involve not only a contemplation of who the individual is, but also who they associate with. If a white person is fired because they spend time at the lunch table with black employees, that is a form of race discrimination.
That's a good comp. That's a good comparison. We're talking right now with Sarah Warbelow, joining us from Human Rights Campaign, John Aitzmo of the Foundation for Moral Law, talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to take up three different cases, two of which would be combined, having to do with individuals who were fired because of their sexual identity. The third case, which would be heard at least at this point separately, involves a transgender employee of a funeral home who was fired once the individual either stated or it became clear that gender transitioning was occurring. Let me go back to you, Mr. Aitzmo. We have a listener who asked the question, given that so much of the opposition to having protections against LGBTQ people in the workplace comes from people who have a religious perspective about that, have a moral opinion about that, couldn't it be argued that that is a form of religious discrimination against individuals and that that is banned by Title VII?
I think it's a form of religious discrimination against the employer who has those religious convictions, as certainly is the case in regard to the Harris Funeral Home. If the Harris Funeral Home is operated as a Christian ministry, which it is, and if their Christian beliefs prohibit transgender, they should be allowed to practice those beliefs, and particularly if they're going to have customers, the relatives of the deceased, who have strong convictions on this issue. And certainly there's no area where persons' religious convictions, moral convictions, emotions, and the like are going to be more sensitive than at a funeral. And the religious convictions of these customers and of these employers certainly deserve to be taken into consideration. I mean, the First Amendment speaks about establishment of religion, but it also speaks about free exercise.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us from the Foundation for Moral Law, Christian Advocacy Organization, Senior Counsel John Aitzmo, who doesn't see the Civil Rights Act applying to LGBTQ employees. Sarah Warbelow, the Human Rights Campaign, legal director of that civil rights advocacy group based in D.C. They do favor the extension of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act to the LGBTQ populations. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, the controversy over Florida police's sting operation at massage parlors using hidden cameras. A group of customers who were getting legitimate massages but were viewed on that video are suing for invasion of privacy. We'll talk about the case and its many layers back in 1 minute. Attorneys for two Florida massage parlor employees are asking a judge to hold police and prosecutors in West Palm Beach, Florida, responsible for a possible unauthorized release of video that the employees say shows New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft paying for sex. The New York Daily News reporting someone anonymously contacted the site TheBlast.com, saying they had video showing Kraft with another person, presumably a massage therapist at the Orchids of Asia Day Spa in Jupiter, Florida. Now, this follows by a day a lawsuit that's been filed by nearly three dozen men and women. It's been filed as a federal class action effort accusing Florida authorities of unlawfully videotaping them as they received legal massages at that Orchids of Asia Day Spa where New England Patriot owner Robert Kraft and others allegedly paid for sex. The question here is, why did a judge approve hidden cameras going inside the spa? You know, one of the main premises of the investigation was that women were being sexually trafficked out of that location. But there have been a lot of questions as to whether that was in fact true, whether there's good evidence that such was occurring, and whether the judge should have issued the warrant which allowed for the surreptitious videotaping inside the park. parlor. Joining us is Danielle Citrin, professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So I'm not aware of any massage parlors here in Southern California where prostitution has been alleged. Using hidden cameras, that sort of technique, because of the privacy questions that that raises, is this something, to your knowledge, that's commonly been done?
So no, and I think it's important to just at the outset to recognize that sexual privacy is a crucially important interest because, of course, it's indispensable for how we have autonomy over our bodies, and our sense of intimacy is certainly impaired if we think we're being watched, and, of course, how our dignity, right, the way we see ourselves. So no, I haven't heard of other massage parlors taping surreptitiously clients. But, you know, that's in some respects a different question than what we see here, right, which is the question of whether the government can collect that information pursuant to a valid warrant, and is that search reasonable or unreasonable? And I think the more profound question, what prompts this lawsuit, is whether that those videos can be distributed, disclosed to the public, and whether that sort of disclosure would violate the constitutional right to information privacy that those individuals have.
Well, but this, the lawsuit filed yesterday by the 31 individuals alleges that the Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg, the Jupiter, Florida Police Department, and the lead detective in the case violated their rights to privacy when they were videotaped getting massages. I don't think it's just about it being released. It's that they were surreptitiously watched by other individuals while they were receiving legitimate legal massages. Do you think that there's much of a case there?
I guess what I think is important to recognize is that a court, a judge, intervened here and issued a warrant based on probable cause for the taping. So to frame it as like a secret taping of clients is to take away the fact that the framework here is that there was a judge who issued a warrant based on probable cause to obtain that video. And so I've been writing about sexual privacy and have a forthcoming book on sexual privacy, but I think it's really important to recognize that there are times in which secret taping is, we say, lawful because there is legal process behind it. And here we have a judge issuing a warrant. And I think the real crux of the issue, besides the disclosure, is whether the secret taping backed by a warrant was reasonable.
And do you think that the judge made a good decision in allowing the warrant for the recording inside the spa?
It's hard. I mean, I'd have to look at the precise information before the judge and what was considered the affidavits the judge considered, the risks that the judge assessed in making this determination. It seems like it's not just the misdemeanors involving people soliciting prostitution, but the broader set of circumstances of what was going on inside that, you know, the massage parlor. So it's really hard to, and if this the question is brought to the court, they will assess whether the judge, it was reasonable for the court to order to sign off on a warrant based on probable cause that allowed them to install the video cameras.
Danielle, I know you have to run. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to your book as well. That's Danielle Citrin, professor, University of Maryland School of Law, also with us, frequent Air Talk guest from our own Loyola Law School here in Los Angeles, professor and former federal prosecutor Lori Levinson. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. What do you think are the legal prospects of this group of 31 individuals suing law enforcement over this action?
Well, I think Professor Citrin was right on point when she said that the key issue is going to be whether those warrants that were issued were reasonable and based upon probable cause. They might have very well been overbroad, but if they're close, then we let the officers do it if they act in good faith. It's going to be an uphill battle on a lawsuit to challenge what the officers did it if they did it pursuant to a court order. What people are really upset about is why would the judge issue this? And to answer that, we need to know what kind of information the judge was getting. Was it accurate? Was it overblown? Was it speculative? They're going to dig deep into that.
One of the issues that law enforcement has been pressing on this, including in the news conference after the arrests of the men alleged to be customers receiving illegal sexual services, was that there was trafficking of the employees. In other words, that they were either coerced, threatened, in some way were not of their own free will employed at the massage location and did not have the legal protections that employees need to be afforded. If it was found that part of this fell apart, and the argument that law enforcement was making that this was a, you know, a hub of trafficking or trafficking was going on, would that aid the people that are suing, or would that not be relevant to their lawsuit?
Well, it could be relevant, but don't forget, hindsight is a lot better. I mean, the issue is going to be that when the officers went to the judge, what kind of information did they have? Who did they have it from? How reliable was it? I can certainly understand that if they went to the court and said, we have an institution that's engaging in human trafficking, the judge is going to take that very seriously and probably issue several warrants. But the scope of it is important. And if it turns out that people exaggerated, that the officers acted recklessly or intentionally misled the court, then this would blow up in their face.
Prosecutors recently acknowledged in court they have no evidence that any employee of Orchids of Asia is a victim of sex trafficking. If that was the primary base for getting the warrant, then it would seem that that did not pan out. Obviously, you know, prosecutions for prostitution activity at storefront massage parlors takes place around the country. Lori, that's typically done with officers going in undercover, right? And then when sex acts are solicited, that's typically how they enforce this?
That is a pretty standard undercover operation to send people in and to basically have them play roles so that they can see what's happening. It's much more extreme to go ahead and start taping these activities because of exactly what we saw here. You may have some individuals who are crossing the line, violating the law, but you might have some people who are not.
And the judge, I know, is taking under consideration whether videos will be made publicly available to news organizations who have made requests for the videos. What are the legal issues that the judge is likely considering in that decision?
Well, I think the judge is doing a balancing act. Here, you know, of course, there are First Amendment interests in the media and the public finding out what was going on, what was the nature of the investigation. But on the other hand, there are very strong privacy interests on the other side. So I think that many courts would be reluctant to release this information, at least to release it wholesale or unredacted. I think a court has to be very careful because of the tough balancing involved.
Now, there allegedly was video from this operation that was offered to a website. If the leak of that is traced back to someone employed by one of the law enforcement agencies involved, could there be legal exposure damages against the employer of the person who leaked it?
Well, I would expect that there would be some challenges, both internally and maybe even lawsuits for violation of Fourth Amendment rights. I mean, that's very extreme. And we've seen the Supreme Court basically try to protect people's privacy, even when there's a law enforcement operation. Years ago, the court said, for example, you couldn't just send the media along to see what they do on searches and other types of investigations. That might violate privacy. This goes one step further. So indeed, if you have people trying to sell this type of private information that the court has not ordered release, they're going to be in trouble with the court whether or not there is a lawsuit.
All right. Before I let you go, anything else to add that you think is notable about this case? I mean, it certainly seems very different to me than the kinds of prosecutions for prostitution that we've seen locally.
Well, a couple of observations is, oftentimes the best defense is a good offense, and law enforcement seems to have offered that to Kraft and other possible suspects in the case. In other words, by going so extreme in their investigative methods, perhaps they had their eyes on particular targets. Law enforcement really opened themselves up to becoming more on the defensive in this case.
All right. Professor, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Loyola Law Professor Lori Levinson with us on Air Talk. Hey, I hope you'll join me for our next Film Week screening. This is our series of quarterly movies that are set in Los Angeles. We show at the Theater at Ace Hotel downtown on the beautiful big screen in the gorgeous historic theater that began life in 1927 as the flagship United Artists Theater. We'll be back on July 27th, Saturday night, and we're going to show, obviously set in L.A., Boogie Nights, the San Fernando Valley, late 70s, early 80s, as the adult film industry transitions to a home video, much lower budget business, and the intersecting lives of people who work in that business, all portrayed with an extraordinary ensemble cast under the direction and reading the words of Paul Thomas Anderson, a classic film, Boogie Nights, Saturday, July 27th, theater at Ace Hotel downtown. Get your tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. I sure hope to see you there. We'll be back talking about how so many younger Angelenos are delaying getting their driver licenses. Why are they waiting so much longer? And if you're a parent of a teen, what do you think about that? We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're riding along talking about teen drivers. And the statistics are stark on the drop in Gen Zers getting their driver licenses. Gen Zers, those roughly born after 1997. And we've just seen a huge drop, a sharp decline. Nearly half of 16-year-olds have a driver license now. About a quarter of them have a driver license now. Nearly half did as recently as 1993. So what's going on? The question is, you know, why are younger people deciding to wait? Now, I'm sure there are regional differences. If you live in a rural area of the country, more than likely a teen's going to get a driver license earlier because you got to get places and not necessarily rely on mom and dad to get there. In more urban areas, if there's money in the household for Uber or Lyft or getting rides from friends or mom and dad take you around, that's still an option. My question for you is, if you are a parent of a teen or you yourself are a teen, what are your feelings about your child or you yourself getting a driver license? What do you think? Are you glad if they're delayed that they're waiting to get it? Have you tried to encourage them to get it younger? What's going on in your household over driving? Our son got it the first legal day when he turned 16. It was really important to him to be able to drive, to be able to have that independence, to go places he wants, not to have to rely on ride sharing or friends or my wife or I. He wanted to have that mobility and autonomy. But I have to say, most of his friends, I don't think, did have their licenses when they turned 16. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With me is Tyson Jomini, who's the vice president of data and analytics at JD Power. Tyson, thank you for joining us. What do your surveys say about why younger people are delaying getting their licenses?
And thanks for having me, Larry. Happy to be here. So one of the things we're certainly seeing is there's a lot of economic factors at play for why younger drivers are delaying it. And as we know, it's expensive. Teens are expensive. Teen drivers are expensive. It's expensive to insure them, and it's expensive to get a car for them. So we understand there's a lot of economic factors at play here.
You know, even if my son, though, didn't have his own car to drive, I'd still want him to have the license so that, you know, on family driving trips, he could spell us, that he could take one of our cars, even if, you know, we didn't have a car for him. So to me, there's still advantages. I guess there's still the insurance issue, but at least you don't have, you know, an additional car necessarily. So beyond the financial issues, are you able to quantify how much ride-hailing services factor into this?
We're getting fairly close to what that answer would be. And what I think we're seeing here is our total loss so far on the new side is about 120,000 sales to this Gen Z cohort. That's just on the new side. So, of course, we know that some of them are going over to the used side as well. And so we are seeing approximately 3/4 or so of those buyers going over to the used side as well. So then we have a balance there. And I think that's where we really need to do a bit more understanding of, well, where are these Gen Zs going? Is this shared services? Is this the amount? And the answer is most likely, well, yeah, that's certainly a factor in there, along with other things we probably know, such as smartphones and online gaming and ways that younger consumers and people can connect with each other these days.
866-893-KPCC. Mike in Altadena, I understand you have three adult children, or I guess one adult, the other two are teens. So how did you talk to them about driving, and when did they decide to get licensed?
Yes, Larry, I totally agree with you. I got them on the road early as possible. I drove a lot with them. My oldest was interested, and I just feel it really gives them a good sense of autonomy. I think if they're pursuing work, like if they're in high school and they want jobs, I have one, you know, who has a job, he can drive to work. The other one drives his brother around. It just works out really well for us as parents. And I really don't understand why some of the parents are, I think it's a fear factor mostly, that they're afraid that their kids are going to crash. And, you know, that happens. And my kids have gotten in crashes. But, you know, it's just part of being a kid and driving.
866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Also with me from Motor Trend Features, editor Scott Evans. Scott, how much of this do you think has to do with the financial part Tyson raised? Because, I mean, one of the things we see here in Southern California is used car sales have exploded because it's so much more convenient than public transit. And I'm wondering, is, you know, are any of that used car sales going to teen drivers?
Well, absolutely they are. But you're right. Cars are expensive. They're expensive to buy. They're expensive to maintain. And they're expensive, especially if you're a teen driver, to insure. And if you live in an urban area, which most of America does, you might have trouble finding in parking, and you may have to pay for it, too. So combine that with an explosion of alternatives, of ride sharing, of bike rentals, of scooters, of slowly improving public transport, and suddenly you don't need a car quite as bad as you used to.
All right. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Ian in Irvine. Ian, your experience with your teen.
Yes, hi. I have seen that my 17-year-old, as he approached 15, 16, he and his friends have been really slow to get their license because I think it's because of electronics, because they have entertainment right at their fingertips. They don't need to go anywhere. They can just stay at home and interact with each other online. And also, too, shopping. You don't have to go out to shop anymore. You just shop online. So I think it's electronics is the big factor.
All right, Ian, appreciate it very much. 866-893-KPCC. Let's talk with Sybil in Cerritos. You have a 16-year-old, or I'm sorry, you have a 20-year-old. What did he do when he turned 16?
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
When he turned 16, he wanted to have the driver's license. I wanted him to have it because I'm a single mom. But it was, to me, shocking because I'm an immigrant. I didn't know how it worked, but that I had to pay somebody to certify that he learned how to drive when I taught him. And I'm a driver. I mean, if I have a driver's license, I should be authorized enough to say, you know, you can drive because I'm teaching you. I don't understand why we parents have to pay somebody else to say that they know how to drive.
Yeah.
That's a big expense. I had to pay $300 for
it. Yeah. Oh, it is expensive. Yeah.
It is expensive. And it's like, it's because your interest kind of like, why are they delaying? I don't think they're delaying. They're minors. The parents have to make this decision. And if you don't have the money, how are you going to pay for it?
Yeah. No, it's a very good point. If you don't have the money for insurance, which is a lot more than the cost of the driver training class, then obviously that's not going to be workable. But on the flip side, you have to figure, well, then what are you doing to get your child around? Can your kid rely on public transit, which is a lot less expensive? If so, that's great. If they relying on ride-hailing services, then there's the cost of that to deal with. So, yeah, it's all a, you know, financial balancing. Sybil in Cerritos, thank you so much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Grace in Culver City, what's your experience with your kids and driving?
So I'm a mom of four, and my oldest is 14, and I have been counting down the years till he could get his license. And every time I talk about it, he has absolutely no interest in driving or getting his driver's license. That seems bizarre to me because I got my license as soon as I could. And I really need him to help me out with driving his three younger siblings around.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to.
So do you think that's part of his resistance to get licensed, is he doesn't want to be the chauffeur?
I think he doesn't see a need. We live in a place where I'm very grateful that he walks everywhere. He knows how to take the bus, and he just doesn't see a need, which I think is, you know, demonstrates that our societies are changing. There are other ways to get around, and I think that's great, but I need him to help me out a little. So we're going to have more conversations. I just found it very puzzling that here's a kid who has no desire to drive or get his.
Yeah. Grace, I appreciate it very much. You know, for me, part of it was my parents both really enjoyed driving. And I looked at the pleasure that they took in driving. They were interested in cars. They were very intentional about what cars they chose to buy and to drive. And so I think I just kind of grew up seeing it as a fun thing, as a pleasurable thing to drive a car because I saw the pleasure that my parents took in it. And I wonder if as driving has gotten more stressful in an urban environment, if maybe kids look at what their parents are going through and think, I don't want any part of that. What do you think? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in a minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about a new survey of young Americans finding the percentage of those who are driving at age 16 has fallen to a quarter. Only 25% of teens who are 16 years old get a driver's license now. That's down from half in 1983. I don't know what it was before then. Might have been even more 16-year-olds. My question for you is, if you're a parent of a teen or if you're a teen yourself off of school today, what do you think about that? Do you think it makes sense in your family if your teen is delaying getting a license? Did you try and get your teen to get a license, but she or he didn't want to do so, like the last call that we have? Or are you reluctant to have your teen driving at 16 or 17? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Michael in Orange County says, sounds like Larry's son could be susceptible to becoming the go-to guy for their travel needs by car. You are so right, Michael. Not only that, he's the
one who plans out the trips. When we did that trip cross country a couple years ago, our 2-week trip, Desmond actually put the whole plan together where we were going to go each day, the whole route, and got us onto some of those more rural highways to see areas we wouldn't otherwise. And we're going to be going later this summer to Spain, and he's plotted out the road trip we're going to do there too. So yeah, he's totally into that. By the way, Desmond is going to be on Air Talk with me Thursday. It's Take Your Daughter or Son to Work Day Thursday. So at the insistence of John Raby, Desmond is going to join me for a segment on only children. He's an only child. I'm an only child. We're going to get your input on what you think, the pros and cons of only childhood. Desmond going to join me coming up Thursday on Air Talk, Take Your Son and Daughter to Work Day. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Flora in South Los Angeles. You got a 17-year-old. Is she or he interested in a license?
He is so interested in driving, we can't get him off the car. But the reason why he doesn't have a license yet is because of the high price of insurance and not that many available jobs for people under 18 to help with the cost of the insurance.
Yeah, those jobs are very, very tough to come by. And you're right. If, you know, in the past, I'm sure a lot of teenagers, they took on, if not all, a major part of the expense. So what does your son do instead of driving?
He takes Uber whenever it's farther away. He takes the bus or he walks.
All right. Flora, thanks. I appreciate it. 866-893-KPCC. Flora, echoing the theme, we've heard from so many parents, the cost, it is so expensive, from the driver training program through the cost of insurance. If you get, you know, even a, you know, an old used car for your child, the costs that are associated. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Suzanne in Hollywood says, I thought my 17-year-old son was an outlier when he said he didn't want to learn how to drive. He Ubers everywhere. I'd like him to learn how to drive, but cost-wise, I think ride-hailing makes more sense. Emily in Huntington Beach says, I think the restriction that you have to have a license a year before you drive anyone your own age has changed the game. Teens don't have an incentive because they can't drive their friends. That's a very good point, Emily, and that's sure different than when many of us were kids. And one of the big things was that we could take our friends around. I remember when I was at Hollywood High School, got my license at 16, and I'd stuff my car full of friends, and we'd, you know, drive out to Santa Monica to go to some, you know, a Lemley Theater to see some special, you know, movie showing or something like that. That was part of the appeal. Let's talk with Howard in Mission Viejo. Howard, what do you think's at play here?
You know, I think there's an issue with helicopter parents, of which I think I'm one. I have a 17-year-old, and you know, she got her permit, and we've been trying to get her to drive, and she just has no interest in driving. You know, she has her permit, and she took one class, and she didn't really enjoy it, and we can't quite figure out how to actualize our own more independence for ourselves by having her drive and take more responsibility. So it's been extremely frustrating, and I think it's partly because we've done everything for her. You know, coming from Mission Viejo, you know, the cost of it isn't really an issue. I think that the cost of having her drive, paying insurance, getting her car would equal a lot more freedom for us.
Sure. Yeah, no, that makes – and is this true with most of her friends, to your knowledge, that they're not getting licensed either?
Absolutely. I mean, she has a boyfriend who has a license, and so he can tote her around a little bit now that the year has passed since he had his license, so he can drive her. But, you know, the rest of her friends don't really drive. So
yeah.
I think it's a big issue down here.
Howard, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Let me share some more listener comments. Mary in Culver City, I took my kids out driving to practice when they were 15, but they never got their licenses. They're now 25 and 22. So they just didn't see the point when they were younger to doing it because of that year before they could drive their friends. Of course, now they're over 18, so that that restriction no longer applies. But, Mary, I appreciate your call. Ty in Long Beach says, I have a teenage brother. I'm 11 years older than him. I just was talking with him about getting a car. I think I talked him out of it. He wants a car just as badly as I did when I was a teenager, but it's just not, you know, feasible. That's Ty in Long Beach. And let's see. Karen in Santa Monica says, my daughter wasn't mature enough to be driving when she was 16, and she knew it. But she had generous friends who drove her. She's 22 now, lives in New York City, got her license. But my 15-year-old son, he's more than mature enough. He's already picked out the car he wants. That's Karen in Santa Monica. You can share your comments about teenagers getting their driver license and why so many are choosing not to on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. My thanks to Tyson Jomini of J.D. Power Associates, Scott Evans of Motor Trend. A lot more to come in the second hour of Air Talk. Such pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk this morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, I'm so looking forward to Lori Gottlieb being with us, frequent Air Talk guest, and writes Dear Therapist, the column for The Atlantic. She's spoken with us about so many issues in psychology. Her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And I'm going to open up the phones. If you are a psychologist, clinical social worker who does therapy, marriage family therapist, I'd like to hear from you about how you sort of bring together the therapy you do with your clients as well as the therapy you receive for things in your own life. Do you ever feel kind of split by that? Or are you able to take things you learn about yourself from the therapy that you're in to then use in the therapy you do with your clients? That's coming up a little bit later this hour. But right now, our attention turns to the story you just heard, to topping the NPR news, the U.S. Supreme Court about an hour ago, hearing arguments involved in whether the U.S. government can add a question about citizenship to next year's U.S. Census form. Joining me is Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr. Greg, thank you for being with us. What stood out to you from the arguments today?
What stood out is the likelihood that this will end up as a 5-4 decision, with the conservatives on the court agreeing with the Trump administration, saying it's okay to add this question, asking everybody about their citizenship to the census. The court's conservatives, and in particular the two justices who were the most likely ones to go the other way, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, and Brett Kavanaugh, did not seem bothered by evidence that the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross had had added the questions, not for his stated reasons, which is to help with enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, but for other reasons, and that he might have violated the federal law that governs administrative agencies. So there's an excellent chance we will get a divided opinion like we do get up here sometimes at the court.
Has the government said whether everyone would be asked this or it would only be on the longer census questionnaire that goes to, what is it, 1 out of 6 households?
Yeah, this would be asked of everybody, and it would ask about each individual person. There's a long history of asking about citizenship on the census. This would be the first time that the question was not just directed at the head of a household, but that it was asking about each individual person. And the concern among those who are opposed to the question is that it will lessen participation. People will be afraid, especially if they're not citizens, they'll be afraid about answering the question and won't return the census forms.
Well, and did the justices ask questions along that line? If the majority seemed unconcerned about Wilbur Ross's statements about the justification, did the justices ask questions about the possible deterrent effect on people participating or people lying about citizenship status, making the numbers unreliable?
Yeah, they certainly did, but it was only the court's liberal justices. There were some very strong questions from people like Justice Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Elena Kagan, concerned about that very thing, and pointing to the conclusions and recommendations of the experts at the Census Bureau who said that was what would happen. The counterargument by the Trump administration, which seemed to be accepted by the conservative justices, is it wasn't so black and white. There was enough uncertainty that it was reasonable for Ross to reject that recommendation. And he also had this other motivation, they said, of wanting to help the Justice Department enforce the Voting Rights Act. And Ross's explanation was that this data asking the question would help with that enforcement.
We're talking with Greg Storr, Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter, who was at the arguments this morning at the U.S. Supreme Court in Washington, where they heard the competing perspectives about a citizenship question that the Trump administration wants to put on next year's the census, the 2020 every decade questionnaire that goes out to every American household. Greg, did anyone raise the issue that there could be boycotting of the census beyond just people who are in the country illegally, that people who were upset the question being asked might choose just not to take part in the census altogether?
Yeah, there was a really tense exchange at the very end of the argument where Noel Francisco, the Solicitor General representing the Trump administration, did suggest the possibility of a boycott. Now, he didn't, as I heard it and read the transcript, wasn't specifically saying that will happen in this case, but he raised the idea that if the court ruled against the administration, that sort of thing might happen. And that drew a really sharp response from Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who is the court's only Latina justice. She said, quote, "Are you suggesting that Hispanics are boycotting the census? Are you suggesting they don't have, whether it's rational or not, a legitimate fear?" And then General Francisco responded, "No, not in the slightest. That's not what I'm suggesting." So it was a very tense argument. That exchange was probably the most tense moment in it. But throughout it, the court's liberal justices were really pushing hard. And it seemed as though, at least in my judgment, they were very concerned that there was going to end up with a 5-4 decision that would allow this question on the census.
And this court has tried to avoid that, right? I mean, they're because they recognize 5-4 decisions make it appear as though there's the strict ideological split. So that's not their ideal, right?
Yeah, it certainly seems like they have been trying to avoid that. In particular, Chief Justice Roberts, who's one of the conservatives, seems like he has been trying. And he's talked about how, it's better to have a narrower decision with a broad consensus. That said, he certainly recognizes, everybody recognizes, sometimes that can't be avoided. This is one of those questions. The Census Bureau has to start printing these questionnaires this summer. It's really an up or down question. The court needed to get involved and decide this question. And it may just well be that you have five justices who think one thing and four who think another.
Greg, I know you're a Supreme Court reporter, not census reporter, so you might not know, but do you have a sense of how much of the census will be conducted online versus over the phone versus mail-in printed forms?
Thanks for giving me my excuse not to be able to answer that question. I'm afraid I don't know the answer.
All right. Yeah, I know that's not your beat, but I didn't know if that maybe came up as a part of arguments. Greg, thanks so much. As always, really appreciate your sharing with us the on-the-scene reporting from the Supreme Court.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Greg Storr with us from Bloomberg. Also with us is Caitlin Phillips, who's litigation counsel for the Public Interest Legal Foundation, which is an organization that supports election integrity. Ms. Phillips, thank you for being with us. Your thoughts about the arguments that were made today, and are you feeling fairly confident the justices will go the direction you're hoping?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's always a dangerous game to try to guess the results of a case based on oral argument, but I am optimistic based on what I've heard about the direction of the questions, that the justices got to the heart of the matter and will resolve this in favor of the government.
What are the reasons that you think the government's position is defensible here.
One main point that I think is important is that this is not a wholly new question. This is a question that has been asked in the past on the census that everybody receives, and it's also a question that's been included since 2005 on the American Community Survey that goes to approximately 1 in 38 households annually. So this is not a new question, and it's an important question. And the reason for that, as stated by the Department of Justice, is better enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. And indeed, the Department of Justice relies upon census and citizenship information to enforce Section 2. And so having better, more reliable, more robust data will better equip the department to do its job.
Fed Up writing on the AirTalk page says the reason for a question like this, L.A. County Registrar of Voters for decades had substantial dead people on their rolls and lots of duplicates. About a year ago, over 1 million names were purged as invalid. So each election, the Secretary of State publishes what percentage of eligible voters were registered, what percentage of registered voters voted. But if we don't have a count of the actual number of citizens, then the count of eligible registered voters can be off by 50% or more. It's just a random guess. And if there are duplicates on the voter rolls, then the percent of actual registered voters that voted could be much higher than published. Thus, a valid question to be on a U.S. Census form. The U.S. Supreme Court will find the same. That's Fed Up, writing on the AirTalk page. You can put your comment there as well. Also with us is Aaron Selstrom, who is litigation director at Lawyers for Civil Rights, a Boston-based nonprofit legal organization that fights racial and immigration discrimination. Mr. Selstrom, thank you for being with us. Did you come away from what you heard concerned about that your side may lose this?
Well, we'll wait to see. We'll know soon, probably by the end of June, how this is going to come out. And you never can tell from oral argument. Certainly, it sounds like the liberal justices are on the right side and recognize the intensely problematic nature of adding a citizenship question to the census. And I think there are some who are in the traditionally conservative bloc who may end up agreeing with them. Justice Roberts, in particular, has a very strong institutional view of the court and is reluctant to, as you have said, have too many 5-4 splits that look like it's just a political decision. And so he and perhaps others may eventually come over to the side and rule in what we think is the right way to keep this deeply problematic and historically unprecedented question off of the census.
Now, you said it's historically unprecedented, but Ms. Phillips was saying it had been asked in the past. How do you square that?
Never in the census's 230-year history has the government asked for the citizenship status of everyone in the country. That kind of universal question going to everyone has never happened before. The last time that the census asked each household about any question about citizenship was 69 years ago in 1950. Since that time, starting with the 1960 census, the Census Bureau has taken that question off of the decennial census, specifically because Census Bureau experts recognize the significant problems that are created when you have a question like that on there that people do not answer or will fail to respond. That will result in undercount that will have enormous effects, particularly in states that have high Latino and immigrant populations.
Do you think it would lead to people not filling out the census, or that they would just leave blank the question about citizenship?
I think both are likely to happen. There is tremendous fear in immigrant communities, particularly over the past 2 years of the Trump administration. I mean, think about it. Since day one of the administration, even before, starting with President Trump's campaign, immigrant communities have been faced with a constant barrage of messages that they are unwelcome in this country and that the Trump administration views them as, you know, lesser than. Undocumented immigrants in particular have been told they better watch their back, that they can be seized, rounded up, and deported at any time. And now what the administration is saying is now we're going to go to every household and specifically ask who in your household is a citizen or not. People are terrified, and they're going to be terrified. And absolutely, it's going to lead to people not answering that question, not responding to the census at all. And that was undisputed in the record before the Supreme Court today, that this will lead to an undercount by estimates of 6 to 10 million. That is hugely significant in terms of an undercount that is will happen if this question is allowed to go on the census.
We're talking with Oren Sellstrom of the Lawyers for Civil Rights legal organization, Kaylin Phillips with us from Public Interest Legal Foundation. I'd love to hear from you, your arguments from a legal standpoint, why you think the question about citizenship should be allowed to stand on the census, or why you think the High Court should not allow that to be included. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. The Census Bureau hopes that 55% of Americans will use online responses to the census questions, that be computers, mobile phones, or other devices. And it'd be the first time you have the majority of people who would be responding using some sort of a digital device like that online response. They're also going to follow up with phone calls and are still for certain households where you've got older Americans or lower income households looking at good old fashioned paper mailing of those survey forms. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. John in Monrovia said it would be great if we all rallied around this and had everyone boycott the citizenship box, declined to answer it. Kaylin Phillips of the Public Interest Legal Foundation, I would assume if the question stands that there will be organized boycotts, will that make the question essentially irrelevant because the numbers will be skewed?
Well, I would hope there wouldn't be boycotts. I would hope that rather there would be a drive to rally people to respond to the question, understanding that the responses are confidential under the law, and I would rather see communications about the importance of responding to these questions. And as I said before, this is not a new question. This has been asked on the American Community Survey for many years.
But as our other guest said, what was it, 69 years ago that it was asked of some households, and it wasn't asked on a person-by-person, you know, per-resident basis. It was households. So also given the fact that we've seen data breaches, information be insecure, you think it unrealistic that people would have fears that their citizenship status could be compromised?
I think that if that's a fear, then there are plenty of other questions on the census that many people might find intrusive. However, the census is very important, as evidenced by the amount of attention that this case has gotten. And I think that it's important to make sure that people are aware of the importance of responding to the census and understand that that the law does protect their answers. But the bigger picture is this: the Constitution vests this power to conduct the census with Congress, and Congress has delegated it to the Commerce Secretary. And under our government, the Commerce Secretary has then acted to include questions that achieve the stated purpose of the census, and in this case, response to the Department of Justice request for this kind of information.
Erin and Tarzana says, if I chose not to answer the citizenship question, do they throw out the rest of my census answers or not? Erin, I'm sure they don't. But Oren Selstrom, when people decline to answer, maybe it's an income question or other things, if they declined to answer on citizenship, the rest of the data would still be processed from that census form, right?
That is what census officials have said, and that has traditionally been the way they have acted upon those kind of incomplete surveys. But the real problem is that the administration, the current administration, has now politicized the census in this way that people are talking about boycotting or not filling out or making it into some kind of political statement. And that is really deeply problematic because the census is so critical to, you know, congressional apportionment, to federal funding. It's traditionally been done in an apolitical way precisely because it is so important to so many aspects of our lives. And to see this kind of anti-immigrant politics injected into it by the Trump administration is part of what is so deeply troubling about this case.
What about the listener comment I shared earlier? The point that if there's not an accurate count of citizenship, it makes it difficult to know what you're dealing with eligible voters, where you're at percentage of registration of the population. It doesn't give you an accurate count necessary for that.
Well, there are lots of different data sets that are out there, and the district court judges who looked at this case, cited to quite a few different data sets that are out there that can be used to get this data for various different purposes. But what they also saw was that the census's most important job is pretty simple. It's to count the number of people that are living in the United States. Adding additional questions, adding complications to that makes that count less accurate. And so, to the degree there are other things that we might want to know about households living in the United States, the census is really not the place to be asking that, because what we need the census to do is to do an accurate count of everybody who is living in the United States, citizen, non-citizen, adult, child. We want to know how many people are living here.
But your argument that citizenship
experts,
that citizenship hold on. I'm short on time. I need to ask a follow up. So if your argument, though, that the citizenship data is available elsewhere, can't you make that argument about everything that's on the census? If you're going to say, well, it's accurate enough what we have about citizenship because that's available in all these other data sets. Well, that's true of income. That's true of all kinds of stuff. So then why do we need a census?
What it's not true of is how many people are living in the United States and where are they living?
We don't have good other means of getting to that.
No, everybody relies on the census for that information because by constitutional mandate, that is what the Census Bureau is set up to do. And that is its main charge. And anything additional that is overlaid on top of that, particularly if it's done in this kind of politicized way, is going to make that data less accurate. And we will all suffer because of that.
All right. Kaylin Phillips, quick response to that, please.
I think it's important to note that we're never going to get a 100% perfect count. There always is discussion every time this comes up, every 10 years, about the choices that we're making on the census form. But here, asking about citizenship yields benefits that we cannot get anywhere else. And so therefore, it's an important question. It was added with important reasons behind it.
We have Ron in Newport Beach who says the last time the question was asked was 2000, contrary to what was said. Is that true, Kaylin?
No. Well, I guess I would ask if he's referring to the long form or the short form. The last time it was asked of all people on the census was 1950. However, it has been included on the American Community Survey since its inception in 2005.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the clarification. And Diane in South Pasadena, quickly your comment, please.
Hi. I was a census worker for the census test here in the San Gabriel Valley 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I, South Pasadena, San Marino, the higher income areas, people were much more cooperative. But Highland Park, El Sereno, with a lot of Spanish speakers, and by the way, I'm bilingual, they were very reluctant to participate and were worried that their data would not be kept confidential.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure in a lot of cases, if you've got people that are immigrants from other countries, there's not necessarily reason to trust the government that's going to keep information confidential. Diane, I appreciate that. So, Kaylin Phillips, what if they're already, without even a citizenship question, is a higher degree of distrust of government privacy? Don't you think asking this question is going to raise the level of distrust higher?
Well, I think that my point stands about how if you're distrustful of the government, then you are likely distrustful of more than just the citizenship question. However, there might be other ways to mitigate those concerns through public awareness of the confidentiality laws that are in place for this data.
All right. Diane in West L.A. also wondering about the homeless population. My recollection is back in 2010 that there were whole teams of census folks who went out and contacted people who were living in camps and living on the street to try and do interviews with them, get those forms filed, and to get that information as part of this database. So, yeah, even people who don't have a home or an apartment, a place, you know, a formal place of residence, the government tries to capture those individuals as well. My thanks to Oren Sellstrom of Lawyers for Civil Rights and Kaylin Phillips of the Public Interest Legal Foundation. Once again, the U.S. Supreme Court this morning heard arguments in the case over whether the federal government can add a question about citizenship to the census form next year when the 2020 census is undertaken. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, I'm going to talk with psychologist Lori Gottlieb. She writes the Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic, frequently joins us on Air Talk, and her brand new book is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. We're going to take this next portion of the program to talk with those of you who are mental health professionals. If you are a psychologist, psychiatrist, a licensed clinical social worker, marriage family therapist, anyone who works with psychological counseling with clients, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about how your work, as well as dealing with matters of your own psychology, your own emotions, your private life, how you navigate that. In her new book, Lori Gottlieb writes about not just the clients, some of the more interesting ones in her practice here in Southern California, but also about entering therapy herself after a major life event and sort of navigating being both the patient as well as being the doc. Lori Gottlieb's book is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. So I'd like this to be a big kind of, you know, group conversation with other therapists. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I guess I'm sort of the ultra junior member. I have a degree in psychology, and that's as far as that goes. Lori, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's talk about your experience. So you had a breakup. You go into therapy, and how difficult was it for you to make that transition, bring the person in control, the person hearing other stories, to being vulnerable and open to share your experience with a therapist?
It's interesting because in the therapy room, it's hard to take off your therapy hat sometimes, but you really have to just be a person when you're in there to talk about your own struggles. And, you know, I did all the things with my therapist that I think my clients do with me. I wanted him to like me. I wondered if the person in the waiting room, you know, was more interesting than me that I would see when I was leaving. I Googled him one night and, you know, got some information on him. And I know that clients do that with me because inevitably they slip up. They'll say things like, well, you know what it's like raising a middle school boy when I've never mentioned that I'm a parent or that I have a son. So, you know, I think you just have to be vulnerable in that room because you're there to work through something that you can't see in the same way that your therapist can.
It's so hard. The times I've been in therapy in my life, the therapists seem so together because you're not hearing much about their personal life. So I'm always imagining, well, what do you know? They have something that would relate in their experience to what I'm sharing, or what? And so, kind of, what are the ethics about disclosing things where you might personally relate to the person that you're seeing, but it not intruding into the process, you know, being about you as opposed to them?
It's very important that you're very intentional about anything you might disclose about yourself. And the question you have to ask yourself every time is this going to benefit my patient? Is this in the best interest of the person who came here to see me? So for an example, one of my colleagues who has a son with Tourette's was treating someone who has a son with Tourette's, and she did disclose that she has a son with Tourette's because this person felt very isolated in her experience and she felt like no one understood what those challenges were really like. And in this case, it was a really wise disclosure. But there are, you know, in most cases, we wouldn't disclose something about our personal lives, but we would use it. And I always like to say, like in the book, I say, I'm a card-carrying member of the human race and my humanity is my greatest tool. So the fact that I have had struggles like any other person helps me to understand my patient's struggles, even if they might be different from mine.
And do you feel like any insight gleaned from your own therapy has made you a better therapist?
Oh, absolutely. In the book, the therapist that I go to see, I'm a new therapist at the time that I go to see him, and he's much more experienced than I am. And he really brings his whole personality into the room. And by that, I don't mean disclosure. I mean that he's just very real and authentic and at ease in the room in a way that I think when we're training as therapists, we don't know that we can be. So, you know, and many times I'll even take something that he said and then drive to my office and then repeat the same thing for the next five sessions. There was one thing that he said. He was talking about a cartoon and he said, you know, you seem to feel so trapped by your circumstances. And he said, you remind me of a cartoon of a prisoner shaking the bars, desperately trying to get out. But on the right and the left, the bars are open. And it was so powerful for me that I actually brought that to many of my clients who also found it very powerful.
Your therapist, Wendell, you describe as being so opposite of yourself. And what are the pros and cons, when, particularly speaking of your clients, where they're very, very different, might take real work of yours to kind of get where they're at and to understand their feelings or empathize versus someone you feel like is really close to you, you get them right away?
I think sometimes it's more dangerous if you feel like they're very close to you because you need to separate out who they are and what their experience is from who you are and what your experience is. I think with the people who are more different from you, it's easier to focus on what's going on with them without a lot of counter transference, our own feelings coming up in this experience.
We're talking with Lori Gottlieb, her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. She shares about a number of the clients that she's had over the years, as well as her own process of entering therapy and what she's learned along the way. She writes the regular column, Dear Therapist, for The Atlantic, 866-893-KPCC. So I'd like to hear from other therapists. If you are a mental health professional, what are the ways that you help to keep yourself balanced, help to deal with the stresses of the profession? How much do you share with colleagues about, you know, cases that you might find challenging or maybe you're finding a difficult way in with a client? What are some of the things that you find particularly challenging at an emotional base? I'm not talking about dealing with insurance, although that can be a stressor. But 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, KPCC. Alan Westwood's wondering, is it a requirement for therapists to undergo therapy themselves?
When we're training, we do 500 hours of therapy, but I think it's very different once you're in practice and once you have some experience going back to therapy, which is what I do and what I write about in the book. Because when you're training, I think you still feel very much like the patient. And I think once you've had some experience as a therapist, you feel like you know a lot, even though that's not the knowledge that's going to help you when you go to therapy.
Darren messaged on the Facebook page, says, I love this segment today. I'm an LMFT, licensed marriage family therapist. I can honestly say I learned more about being a therapist by being a client than I did from school. My relationship to therapy started when I was 19. I'd gone for 10 years before I even got to the point of going to school to become a therapist. I think it should be mandatory for those in school to be a therapist, to see a therapist for far more hours than they are currently mandated. That's Darren, who messages us on the AirTalk Facebook page. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Robin Glendale says, I'm a marriage family therapist in training. I go to my own personal therapy as well. The importance of self-care, having a therapist myself is a high priority. It's paramount to my health. 866-893-KPECC. Is it more difficult, do you think, in some ways for therapists, Lori, to disclose things that are difficult, that you might feel shame or embarrassment? Do you think for someone who is in therapy, who's the authority figure, than for perhaps the typical client?
I think so. I think we all come to therapy with secrets, whether we're a therapist or not. I think we keep secrets from the world and we keep secrets from people close to us. But most people who come to therapy keep secrets from their therapist, and they also keep secrets from themselves. And I think that if you are a therapist, that's heightened because we may have more shame around our secrets because we feel somehow that we're supposed to be more together than the average person. And yet we're just regular people. So I think that, secrets are all about shame. And Carl Jung called secrets psychic poison, I think, because they're so corrosive. And I think that sometimes therapists have a harder time revealing things about themselves for fear that, you know, when you're sitting in therapy and you're talking to a therapist, you worry that your therapist is going to think, and you're a therapist?
Yeah.
You're telling me this and you're a therapist?
Well, and you also write about this, you know, questioning oneself, which everyone in any profession does. But in yours, where you're such a centrally important figure in your patients' lives, there's such a sense of responsibility in what you do that that sort of question will, am I a fraud because I have this unresolved issue or this thing I can't face in myself? Does that mean, therefore, I don't have standing to deal with this with a client, even though I would argue those are two very different things?
Well, right. And in fact, it's interesting because the fact that we are going to therapy and are working through our issues makes us a better therapist. And yet people don't necessarily want to see that. So I write in the book about a colleague of mine who was trying to get pregnant and was really struggling with that. And she finally was pregnant and she was standing in a Starbucks when her doctor called and said the pregnancy wasn't viable. And she broke into tears right there in the Starbucks. And one of her clients happened to walk in, saw her, left, and never came back. So I think that that's where part of the stigma is that people don't want to see the fact that we are human, even though it's so important for us to be able to talk to therapists and work through our own issues so that we can bring our best selves to the therapy room.
See, if I saw my therapist in tears, I would think, wow, you know, they are human. That's interesting. But the idea that the therapist would be struggling with something would make a patient not want to see the person.
Right. And yet, if I saw that, I would trust the person all the more. I would feel safer with that person because at least that person understands struggle, even if her struggles are different from mine.
It's just human. James in Pasadena, thank you for joining us. You're on with Lori Gottlieb.
Yeah, I'm a younger psychologist in the area. I've been licensed about 3 years or so. I work a lot with teenagers, and I find that at times when it's appropriate disclosing my own therapy, that I've been in therapy before, or that I continue to see a therapist from time to time, you know, to support my own emotional needs, can actually be quite powerful. It can be a great way to, you know, relate to those teenagers and to reduce some of the stigma that they might be feeling. I also find that amongst my peers, it's actually quite common. I think folks in my maybe generation of therapists, especially who do the kind of work that I do, I would say most of us will go to see a therapist from time to time. And in our conversations with one another as we consult, it might come up pretty casually. So it seems to me that overall it's a trend towards this being kind of an accepted norm, at least, you know, kind of within the folks that I tend to work with.
James, given also that you're fairly new to the profession, I think you said you've been licensed for 3 years. Are there things that your teen patients disclose to you or things they're going through that kind of trigger stuff in yourself that might connect to experiences you had as a kid maybe you hadn't thought about or bring stuff back? Does that ever happen, or are you highly compartmentalized where there isn't any slop over from the professional to the personal?
No, in fact, the kind of maybe theoretical approach that I ascribe to, I really try to bring as much of myself as is appropriate to the therapy, you know, and I try to always pay attention to where it crosses that line into what's beneficial to the client or not. But I find that being as real of a person with my clients as I can, and at times connecting with some of their story without, you know, making the session about me, can be tremendously helpful and can take it from a teenager who's kind of has their arms crossed and is kind of skeptical to just someone who just opens right up and dives right in. So I find actually that when the content from their lives sort of triggers my content, so to speak, for the most part, it's a really helpful thing.
That's good.
It's not something that gets in the way.
Yeah. James, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for sharing your experience. James, a psychologist who's been licensed for 3 years, primarily working with teens. We're talking with Lori Gottlieb, her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. We'll talk with Lori more about her experiences as a therapist in Los Angeles, and we're taking calls from professional mental health professionals like James. Your experience, your own therapy versus what, as a clinician, you're doing too. 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. Wonderful to get the input of mental health professionals as we talk about both, you know, being the professional with someone who's in need versus yourself getting therapy. And that's what Lori Gottlieb writes about in her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist in our lives revealed. She's not only in private practice, but she also writes the Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic. She's been with us many times on Air Talk, and she has an event coming up Thursday night. She'll be at Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills. It's a Writer's Block Presents event with LA Times and Time Magazine columnist Joel Stein, or former Time Magazine columnist, I should say, Joel Stein, Lori in conversation with him. Writer's Block Presents, 7:30 Thursday night, Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills. We have a link on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org, for you to get tickets for that event. As just asking James, our last caller, about, you know, his clients bringing in personal things, whether that triggers anything. You detail in a number of the experiences with your patients, you're really going through emotional experiences with them. One of them was a patient who was diagnosed with cancer. You went through real highs and lows with her.
Yeah, and I liked what James was saying about sometimes bringing yourself into the room that way. When she was a young newlywed, she came back from her honeymoon. She thought that this feeling in her breast was pregnancy. That's what they were hoping for. And it turned out it was cancer. And ultimately, it ends up being terminal cancer. And she asked me if I'll stay with her until she dies. And we don't know how long that's going to be. They say it could be, you know, anywhere between 1 and 10 years, which, of course, the difference between 1 year and 10 years is enormous. And I go through this experience with her that was both heartrending and profound, I think, for both of us. And there were times when she would get, you know, something would seem to be working and then the miracle drug wouldn't be working anymore. And we would sometimes cry together. We would talk very openly about death in a way that sometimes I think my instinct is what everyone's instinct is when you're faced with death, which is to deny death completely. Like, oh, those experimental treatments might work. But you can't do that. You have to really be in the trenches of the reality of her situation with her. And, you know, we wrote her obituary together. It was a really, really profound experience. But you have to take care of yourself, too. So when you're going through that with her, you also have to make sure that you are talking to your own therapist about the impact of you're going to miss this person, you're grieving her death as well.
When you had a session scheduled with her, when she had the terminal diagnosis, were you able to book patients afterward, you know, within the next hour, or did you have to give yourself a buffer because you knew you'd be so emotionally affected by those sessions with her?
I think in some ways, and this is going to sound strange, but there were so many heroic moments in those sessions with her. She was so inspiring in certain ways, and she was funny. And, you know, I think that those sessions were not – they were difficult, but they weren't draining, because we were having this really rich emotional experience together. And I also think that I write in the book about how there's no hierarchy of pain, that pain is pain. And so I could go from a session with the person I call Julie in the book talking about tumors and scans to someone who comes in and says, you know, my husband won't initiate sex with me. And it's not that it's more trivial. It's very difficult when someone that you love, when you feel rejected by someone that you love. And so we can't really rank our pain that way. And I think that it helps therapists to go from all different kinds of experience back to back with different kinds of clients.
Yeah. Lori Gottlieb with us. Maybe you should talk to someone or book Paul in Pasadena. Gosh, we have all the therapists in Pasadena. Says, I'm a psychiatrist. Among those I work with in the psychiatric community, there tends to be a wounded healer archetype. A lot of times as a psychiatrist, we go into this field because it helps us solve our own problems, helps us get a better sense of empathy with others. You think that's true, Lori, that the field does attract people who are going through the process of dealing with their emotions?
I think there are certainly people like that in the field, but I don't think that that's predominantly what you'll find. I think that there are kind of these two stereotypes of the therapist. One is sort of the brick wall, you know, the one who's like very distant and kind of doesn't say much and doesn't really get emotionally in there with you. And I think the other one is sort of the train wreck, the hot mess. And I don't think that either of those reflects the majority of therapists who are out there. I think the majority of therapists are people who are very empathetic and curious about the human condition and interested in helping people.
I'm curious about stigma, too. You know, as someone who was growing up in the 1970s, my sense is that there was a tremendous amount then as people were, you know, searching in religions and human potential movement, that therapy became kind of normalized, at least among, you know, middle class Americans, affluent Americans. Do you sense that in any way we've regressed from that as you know, sort of drugs of, in many cases, antidepressant taking the place of talk therapy? Or do you think that we have, that it has been destigmatized?
I think that the therapy you're talking about was almost like yoga, right? It was sort of a way to, you know, kind of understand yourself better. But I don't know how much work people did in that therapy. And I think that most people understand now that therapy is hard work. And it's really a process of somebody holding up a mirror to you to help you see your blind spots, to help you see your reflection in a way that you don't already, so that you can see, oh, this is how I'm shooting myself in the foot over and over and ending up in the same place. And we always say that insight is the booby prize of therapy, meaning that You can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't make changes out in the world, the insight is useless. So we want people not only to learn things in the therapy room, but to make changes when they walk out of our office.
Lori, thank you for joining us again. Appreciate it so much.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Larry.
Lori Gottlieb, maybe you should talk to someone. A therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed Thursday night. Writer's Block presents event at Temple Emmanuel, Beverly Hills. A link on the AirTalk page. Have a great afternoon.